On June 20 and 21, 1981, Casablanca became the stage for massive demonstrations of anger, with thousands of people pouring into the streets to voice their frustration and call for change. Students, workers, children, and the elderly all joined together in schools, public spaces, and boulevards. While the protest began peacefully, tensions quickly escalated, leading to violent clashes with the police and a major breakdown in public order. The demands that were voiced by Morocco's urban population weighed heavy on a government that was already overwhelmed by the economic crisis, and these demands couldn't be clearer. Enough. Cut the BS. We've tried to hold on to trust, but keep being pushed to the edge of the strain we can endure. We are done. The people of Casablanca took to the streets like never before, even more fiercely than what it did during the student riots of March 22, 1965, which, side note, I've made an entire episode on a couple months ago. Feel free to check that out, we covered that in detail. In the next couple of minutes, I will try to give you as much insight as I can on this rather heavy episode of Moroccan history, otherwise known as the Bread Riots, which was marked by huge demonstration of political frustration that was deeply rooted in the terrible state of the economy back then, a frustration which was quite tragically met with severe government repression. But to fully grasp and understand the impact of these events, I thought I'd take you through a little bit of the economic and social context that led to these events and that prompted the violence of the aftermath. Not that it ever justifies it, but it cannot be separated from the context like most things. Now, as always, you can find all my sources in the description of the video or the podcast episode, depending on where you're listening from. And without further ado, let's open that portal, shall we? Though I must admit I am no economist, I figured it was essential that I dig deep into Morocco's modern economic history, if that makes any sense, from the 1960s leading up to the 1980s, to really get how it all came to be, essentially, how things escalated the way they did, and how it led to the tragic events of 1981. And on God, you are not in for a dry lecture. I'll make it short and sweet and hopefully complete. Now, historically, modern Morocco, after its independence, went through two main economic periods. The first phase, between 1960 and 1970, can be referred to as a phase of, and I quote, protected development. I hope I make sense, but what that means is that Morocco was trying to grow its economy by having it be very closed off, protecting local industries from foreign competition. The government set up barriers to limit importations of external products, and it tried its best to encourage local production. For example, instead of buying clothes from abroad, we'd have them produced locally. The outcome of that policy was that at first, it did help some local industries like textiles to grow. It led to some years of economic prosperity and even a bit of overheating, if we have to be honest. But the limits of that strategy started to come about over time. Moroccan businesses weren't growing as much as other countries or innovating either because they were too protected from competition, and as a result of that, well, they had a hard time being competitive internationally. The second phase came to be during the 80s and a little bit after that. Between that window, Morocco was dealing with the fallout from what came before, what I've just explained. We were spending more than we were earning, growing budget deficits, the prices of everything were high as hell, the sales of phosphate were terrible, and you know that we depend on it. So in the late 70s and the early 80s, the world was facing a global economic crisis that had many developing countries, including Morocco, Morocco borrow a lot of money, a shit ton of money, leading to another type of crisis, a financial one. Everything was just adding up. Debts were skyrocketing, going from $110 billion in 1973 to $700 billion in 1983. So to quote-unquote assist these countries, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, decided to step in with very strict rules, to say the least. It demanded that Morocco stopped with the whole protectionism move, as we had accumulated excessive foreign debt because of it. Other international financial institutions like the World Bank had been keeping a watchful eye on us too. They all proceed on asking Morocco to start letting external goods and services come in and flow more freely, that we lower the value of our currency, and that we limit government spending, which was pretty high back then. Now, after the events of 1981, Morocco finally decided to change its strategy and to open up Moroccan economy to international competition. That switch happened when the government realized that the protectionist policies from previous decades hadn't worked so well. Sabah al-khair. But that transition between these two political approaches to the economic and financial crisis, as it often is the case, wasn't the smoothest, to say the least. This all leads us to 1981. Under the pressure of the IMF, like we said, and thinking it would help reduce the national budget deficit, the Moroccan government, which was led back then by Prime Minister El Mahdi Bouabid, tried to find money. They tried very, very hard, introduced a series of economic reforms, but in trying, it seems they either didn't foresee the consequences of their choices, which, you know, can happen, it's not easy to run a country, or simply, and that's most likely the case, didn't care that much. Because these solutions they brought to the table included drastic cuts in subsidies for basic essential goods, the ones that are bare minimum for people to breathe, to function, and to survive. What started as an abstract measure quickly became very real in people's everyday lives. The enforcement of these measures led to a sharp increase in the prices of bread, flour, oil and sugar, specifically the price of bread actually, which is, as you know, a basic staple of the Moroccan diet, ended up being increased by 50 to 77%. Now, we always talk about this phenomenon that applies worldwide about, you know, the general disconnect between the high spheres of politics and the reality of the country they're running, but it just baffles me every single time. You can't expect, even from the most passive, understanding, least pressuring citizen in the world, to let him or herself die from hunger when you're literally choking his or her living capacity. It just... The impact of that inflation was immediate and it was no joke. Even the cost of living started to increase sharply, and many Moroccans, particularly those in lower income brackets, found themselves struggling to afford basic groceries. And I don't need to remind you, but it's just not funny being on the receiving end of such disregard for the situation of the lower slash middle class. The initial protests began in early June 1981. Darbeda, Casablanca, Morocco's largest city and pretty much its economic capital, became the source of the unrest. This can be explained by a couple factors, including the fact that Casa was home to a large population of working class that was profoundly impacted by the economic difficulties of the time. There's also something to be said about the state of political awareness and activity of the people of Casa, considering it was a densely packed urban center that had been the beating heart of the administration during the days of the protectorate. Over the previous weeks leading up to the event, frustration had been simmering. For many families, these sudden price hikes were the straw that broke the camel's back. Word had been spreading that a day would come where they would have a chance to voice their frustration, as the entire nation of Moroccans was set to rise up. That day was as June 20th, 1981. Labor unions, which mostly included the Democratic Confederation of Labor and the Moroccan Union for Labor, largely advertised it and overall played a central role in organizing the protest. These two groups had been very vocal about their opposition to the government's measures and about how necessary it was for Moroccans to attend the strikes. Many of their members were among the protesters. They were quick to mobilize workers and citizens through tracts and messengers calling for an end to these catastrophic economic reforms. By mid-morning, groups of people, mostly from the densely populated districts of Derb Sultan, Derb Ghellif, and Hey Mohammadi, started gathering in the streets. In these largely populated, overcrowded almost neighborhoods were living many of the city's poorest residents, making these sectors the beating heart of the discontent. The protest began to form as thousands of people poured into the streets like torrents of water. The protesters were marching towards central areas like Sharia Mohammed Khams and the market of Derb Omar. By early afternoon, the unrest had spread from the residential areas which we mentioned earlier to the principal boulevards, and on the receiving end of that anger, the Moroccan government was growing increasingly alarmed. I mean, sure, the authorities had expected some unrest, but they were far from imagining the scale and the intensity of what was going down, an intensity for which they were completely unprepared. In response, the government deployed the security forces across the city, the police, gendarmes, and the military. Their mission was clear: restore order by any means they deemed necessary. According to some witnesses, the first confrontations began near Derb Sultan and Sharia Mohammed Khams, where the security forces formed lines to block the protesters' advance, but the crowd kept approaching, and as it did, tension reached a breaking point. The police was armed with tear gas and tried to push back the crowds without much success, as the protesters started throwing stones and whatever they could find. The situation quickly escalated as tear gas was fired into the crowd, causing absolute chaos. I am very sure the images are clear in your head, since till this day we see these methods be applied by many countries, including the so-called democratic ones. People started scattering in all directions, but the protest continued to grow. As night fell, the violence of the protest and of the police response worsened. The military was called in and started using live ammunition to separate the crowd. In the neighborhoods of Hey Mohammadi and Derb Sultan, the clashes were particularly stormy. Some protesters tried to defend themselves and to set up barricades, and the streets turned into very weird battle zones under sounds of gunfire, sirens, and screams. A lot of people which weren't part of the protest were arrested as well, just because they happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. The next day, the city was in a state of pure shock. The crackdown had been brutal. According to official reports, which were to come later, the number of casualties, so to speak, were downplayed. Hundreds of people were arrested, hundreds of dead, and many more injured. The days that followed, the government imposed a strict curfew, and the media barely mentioned the riots, instead, you know, focusing on restoring quote-unquote order and blaming the unrest on, you know, external factors. When the riots broke out, the Moroccan government was caught off guard, to say the least, which speaks volumes about, you know, like I said, the eternal disconnect between the governors and the governed, no matter the skill and the qualifications of the governors. In an attempt to crush the unrest, the authorities sent a large number of security forces to suppress the demonstration. The violence and the abuse has actually been recognized by the present government of Morocco, as we will touch on a bit later, since reports emerged with people being arrested without due process, detained without a trial, etc., etc. While these official reports initially stated that, you know, 66 people had died, a couple decades later they changed it to 114. But this number is actually contested by various political groups and human rights organizations in Morocco. I'm talking, don't come with the whole, oh, people from the outside want to crush us. Like, Moroccans' sources here are the ones that I'm mentioning. The Moroccan political party of the Union, I'm going to try and translate it right, but the Socialist Union of Popular Forces, USFP, claimed that approximately 600 people had roughly lost their lives, while the Party of Progress and Socialism, I think that's how you translate it, estimated that number to around 1,000 deaths. More than 5,000 people were arrested by the authorities. After the riots, Gaza felt different. People were more on edge. Everything became a bit quieter, which is hard to do in a city like Gaza. Society was left to mourn and was compelled to do it in silence. Many families had to grieve the loss of loved ones, including young children who had been caught in the chaos. Some people talked about the protests with anger and sadness, but not too loud though. After all, walls have ears, they say. The implications of the government's response to the unrest actually went beyond that. It had an effect on politics and on the way people were perceiving the authorities. It exposed crying divisions between the ruling elite in Morocco and the people, the masses. On to the part of the episode that gives me the most comfort, since up until now I've been pretty depressed, which is the part where we talk about collective memory and restoring it, healing that trauma. A lot of people shy away from speaking about it still, when it doesn't make sense, since Sidna, al-Malik Muhammad VI, acknowledged the gravity of those events and tried to seek justice for the victims and to put words onto what had happened. In 2004, the current king of Morocco set up the Instance Équité et Réconciliation, IER, to address the past abuses from the, and I quote, years of lead, a time that was known for political repression in Morocco. The idea was to help Moroccans come to terms with the difficult memory that was heavy on their hearts. The institution investigated into the Casablanca riots and other incidents of abuse in an attempt to, you know, acknowledge the suffering of the victims and to address the shortcomings of King Hassan Thani's government. They worked in a commission and over the span of 23 months reviewed thousands of cases, interviewed survivors, and came up with a detailed report on the events, which I read so you don't have to. We touched on that a little bit earlier, but what they found was that 114 people had died as a result of the events of June 1981, including many kids under the age of 10 who were shot in the head, chest, and belly, as the report says. However, again, as we touched on earlier, this number is widely believed to be, well, an understatement, to say the least, since many people estimate the true toll to be closer to 1,000. L'Instance Équité et Réconciliation also found out that many victims of the repression weren't properly buried in regular cemeteries. Back then, the authorities had buried bodies without giving them proper religious funerals in two mass graves. L'Instance Équité et Réconciliation, which I repeat was commissioned by Sidna Mohamed Sadis, concluded in its report that the Casablanca riots of 1981, as well as those in 1965 and other instances, were, and I quote, serious human rights violations, including violations of the right to life. Many citizens, including children and people who did not participate in any way in these events, have been victims. The Moroccan government also undertook projects to honor the victims and to preserve their memory. In 2016, the Conseil National des Droits de l'Homme, so the National Council for Human Rights, I guess, inaugurated a cemetery that was dedicated to the victims of the June 1981 events. The cemetery, which is located in Gaza, serves as a reminder of the violence and the loss that was experienced collectively during the unrest, ensuring that the memory is preserved. The inauguration of the cemetery was a big step in, you know, helping us address the historical injustices that are associated with that event. It might sound anecdotal to a lot of people and like, oh, get over it, but a lot of families lost fathers who were the breadwinners of those families, and their destinies were never the same after that. So if your family was not impacted as much by those events, then I'm super happy, and I thank God that it's not your case. Mine was not, so I'm super grateful, but it doesn't give any of us the right to undermine what happened. So to know what happened, and I hope I provided enough information and that this podcast episode was complete enough to fulfill this mission, but to know this part of our history, to understand why it went down like it did, not only preserves us Moroccans from any external, inappropriate, noisy questions, you know, from people that basically aren't Moroccans, but it is also, and most importantly, a commitment to remembering the victims and to ensuring that such events are not forgotten.